Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the victory in the Iowa straw poll for Michelle Bachmann and the loss of her Minnesota twin, Governor Pawlenty, who has now withdrawn from the race. The director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota, Lawrence Jacobs, joins us to assess the chances of this insurgent candidate who has all but made Sarah Palin irrelevant. And then we'll look into divisions within the ranks of the Libyan opposition that appears to be not only hampering efforts to remove the Gaddafi dictatorship, but are also raising questions about exactly who NATO is supporting in its protracted effort at regime change through bombing. Wayne White, a former senior analyst with the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research, who has studied Libya extensively, joins us. Then Gloria Steinem joins us. She is the subject of a new documentary on HBO airing on Monday night, Gloria in Her Own Words. The founder of Ms. Magazine and an active member of Equality Now, Gloria will reflect on the status of women in America today and her long struggle to improve it. Joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota. He also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Government at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America, and the Search for Community and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. Thank you for joining us here today on Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you.
And since you are from the state where the Minnesota Twins come from in terms of the Iowa straw poll, one lost and one won, and Governor Pawlenty just pulled out of the race, do you think Michelle Bachmann is a serious contender?
I think there's no doubt at this point that Michelle Bachmann is a serious contender, but we are very early on. She's now going to get the 24/7 scrutiny under the Klieg lights. She's had a history of misstatements. We'll see how she does. I think this is going to be a real test for her, obviously. But there's no doubt she's got tremendous momentum. She's going to be able now to raise significant amount of money, build a national organization, and reach out to a whole new set of followers.
And how much do you think the entrance of Rick Perry the day before, I think fairly effectively timed announcement that he's running, no surprise there, but he did even better in the straw poll, and he wasn't even running, than Mitt Romney.
Well, there's no doubt Rick Perry is going to be introducing a new element. He'll probably take some voters from Michelle Bachmann. I think that's why he jumped in. It's a sign of his awareness of Michelle Bachmann's presence and potential threat to his candidacy. But he's got a long way to go. He's now going to get that 24/7 scrutiny. He's got a record. He's had some Tea Party folks down in Texas go after him pretty hard, and I think we're going to see quite a bit of that in the coming weeks.
So you think that he's vulnerable from the Tea Party? I thought some of his statements were even more radical than what they've said.
Well, he's got a set of positions on immigration that the Tea Partiers down in Texas have skewered him for. There was also some criticism of him in terms of his budget and not really ratcheting down spending as much as the Tea Party would want. So what we've got is a campaign that is heavily tilted towards the conservative wing of the Republican Party. I think one of the big questions moving forward is whether this group of Republican candidates are moving so far to the right that they're going to have a hard time moving back toward the middle and winning over those independent voters who are so critical in a general election come November 2012.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who's the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about the two politicians from Minnesota, one of whom, former Governor Pawlenty, pulled out of the presidential race for the Republican nomination, and Michelle Bachmann won the Iowa straw poll. And I guess, though, what you're saying, Lawrence Jacobs, is that, I mean, that is a traditional belief in America, that the center is where American politics are, and that in the primaries, the Democratic candidates move to the left, and then moved back to the center, and conversely, the Republicans moved to the right in the primaries and moved back to the center. But how much has America moved to the right? I mean, we've had an example in the last few days in Washington with this debt ceiling hostage situation, where it seems like a very active group on the far right have essentially captured the Republican Party and captured national policy. I don't see anything stirring on the left, let alone the center. So are you confident that your calculus is accurate, or has America moved to the right?
Well, I think you're right that the debate in Washington clearly moved in a pretty conservative direction. You've got Barack Obama competing with Republicans on how to cut spending. So that dynamic is certainly on the conservative end of the political spectrum. But I think when you get to elections, it's going to be a different issue. And if you look at the polling after the debt ceiling debate, you'll see that the Republicans took quite a beating because they were seen as being too conservative. That doesn't really concern them at this point, but as we move towards 2012, it will become a major concern. Now, this is going to be a challenge for them because their candidates are very much on the conservative to right wing of the Republican Party, and it's one of the questions that Tim Pawlenty kept raising, which is, it's fine to be hard right guy or gal, in the case of Michelle Bachmann, but how are you going to beat Barack Obama if you're so far to the right?
So do you think that there's any baggage that's going to come out that we don't know about Michelle Bachmann from perhaps Minnesota, where you are? I mean, for example, I spoke to some journalists a while back in Minnesota who felt that if Pawlenty did well, and nobody was saying that he would, but if he did get more national scrutiny, the issues involved with the collapse of the bridge would come back to haunt him. So that's obviously water under the bridge, for a bad analogy. But tell me about what could come back to haunt Michelle Bachmann as she gets, as you mentioned earlier, that she gets the national Klieg lights, the scrutiny.
Well, I think there's already been some of that scrutiny. Her and her husband founded a clinic that has provided counseling for gays and homosexuals, and tried to kind of convince them that through prayer and religion they could be cured of this. That's gotten some scrutiny, though, of course, among Republican voters. There are plenty of folks who think that's a good idea. I think in terms of kind of the bridge falling in the water type of embarrassment, there's not a whole lot there because, frankly, Michelle Bachmann hasn't really played much of a role in terms of actually governing. I think more likely she's going to get scrutiny for her misstatements that will now become much more public rather than sliding off the national radar screen after a 12-hour or 24-hour news cycle. They're going to start to stick. So the question is, how disciplined a candidate can she be? Then there's the issues raised in recent New Yorker profile that may cheer some of them in the Republican Party, but it's going to, raise questions about Michelle Bachmann's viability as a national candidate who could win a general election.
So do you think, for example, Lawrence Jacobs, that I recall she was interviewed some time back by Chris Matthews, where she accused her colleagues in the House of Representatives of being communists and socialists, that had definite echoes of McCarthy period, which, of course, we thought was somewhat over now, particularly with the collapse of the Soviet Union. But the long and the short of it was, she really was quite, in those remarks, was quite incendiary. And she's obviously totally eclipsed Sarah Palin, and Palin has said similar things, you know, where they draw the line between real Americans and the rest of us. Do you think that is going to win? Obviously, it's going to win supporters on the right, but how much do you think that is against the grain now in current American politics? Obviously, it worked in the 50s, but does it work today?
Well, I don't think it's going to work today in a general election. And I think this is a very important distinction. When you come to the general election, it's a much larger group of people, and it's a more moderate electorate. And that kind of language, particularly when you don't have a Soviet Union existing, is not going to work for Michelle Bachmann. But within the battle for the Republican nomination, it could well work. And I think one of the dynamics moving forward is Rick Perry, Mitt Romney are part of the establishment of the Republican Party. Michelle Bachmann is running not only against the Democrats, Barack Obama, but against the Republican establishment. And as John Boehner, the Speaker in the House, and other Republicans make deals with Barack Obama on the upcoming budget and deficit issues, Michelle Bachmann will continue to stake out an oppositional perspective and continue to denounce the Republican leadership. That could well help her in the battle for the nomination. There are a lot of Republican primary voters and caucus goers who are frustrated with the Republican leadership.
But don't you think, on the other hand, Lawrence Jacobs, that if the press is doing their job, and she's obviously going to have to expose herself more to the press as she becomes a national candidate, surely somebody's going to ask her, and I believe there was a sort of rather half-hearted attempt on Fox to do this with Chris Wallace. The simple question, you know, you were the champion in the House of the Tea Party, calling essentially for the United States to default. And, you know, no serious, sensible person who knows anything about economics thinks that that was a responsible position to take. Is she going to be challenged on that?
Well, I think maybe some reporters will challenge her on it. But again, among a large group of Republican primary voters and caucus goers, that's not an unpopular position. It actually does quite well. I think the tension, though, again, is going to be within the Republican Party battle, because particularly Romney is not going to be supporting that position. He's someone that the business community and the establishment is comfortable with. They are confident that he would not take the country into default. But that's the tension, because Michelle Bachmann is reflecting this more populist uprising among conservatives and Tea Partiers who really don't subscribe to what had been the long-time business orientation of the Republican Party. This is really a battle, again, not just between Michelle Bachmann and Democrats, but it's a battle over the direction of the Republican Party.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacob, director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governments at the University of Minnesota. So could this end up then, could she be in a fairly unenviable position, in as much as she's going to do very well with the base, and she's a real a possibility to become the Republican nominee. But you've made the distinction between the populist base of the Republican Party and the establishment of the Republican Party that supports Mitt Romney. So if you have that establishment versus base situation, she could end up as vice president, because I recall the last time that battle took place was when Ronald Reagan ran against George W. Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, where Bush was the anointed establishment presidential candidate, and Reagan was the populist insurgent. And in order to heal the party after the bruising primary, Reagan chose Bush as his vice president. Could that happen in the reverse situation in 2012, where Romney could beat a Bachmann and then take her on as the VP to heal the party?
It's possible, and you know, I think what's going to be important to see is how this race runs out. It's certainly feasible that Michelle Bachmann is going to be the alternative candidate, would build some support as you run through the early schedule. She could, quite conceivably be the front runner as you move into Super Tuesday in March of 2012. On the other hand, I think there's a real question as to whether we've got a situation with Romney where he's already plateaued So there's just a lot of unknowables here, but certainly Bachmann is a VP candidate. It's conceivable. I think if Perry were to win, or maybe even Romney, they might be looking for a diversity element to their candidacy, including Senator Rubio from Florida.
Yeah, if Perry were to win, of course, it would be the opposite situation where he'd want to put a moderate on to balance the ticket. So I thank you for joining us here today, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota. He also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. And his books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America, and The Search for Community and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break, and we will be back in a moment talking about the Libyan opposition with the former head of research at the Bureau, State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. Also, that will be followed later by Gloria Steinem, who will be joining us. So let's take a break.
Come on now, who do you think you are? Ha ha, bless your soul. Girl, if you're in control, well, I think you're crazy. I think you're crazy.
سب حالي انتك وهونتيني ونسيتك بعد ولعت ونسيتيني يا سب حالي.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran and Iraq. He is also a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups, and as a senior regional analyst. He's also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
So nice to be back, Ian.
And now I think it's perhaps belatedly, but I think it's a good time to focus in on exactly who the Libyan opposition is. They killed a senior general recently. There are reports that they've been infiltrated by Gaddafi's agents, and that now that the Berbers in the West have joined the fight on behalf of the rebels, apparently there's tribal tensions developing. I guess the broad question, Wayne White, is does this explain why this toppling Gaddafi has taken so long, that these guys are not just opaque, but incompetent?
Son, there is incompetence in Libya. In fact, Gaddafi's government himself has been utterly incompetent. It's been like an unmade bed. And fortunate for the rebels, his military is the most poorly trained military in any of the major states in the Middle East. But yes, there is that, and very deep mistrust among various factions within the rebels, which cross-cut various ways. You've mentioned the murder of the former interior minister who served as the commander, the rebel commander in the east, and there's been profound mistrust among particularly younger fighters and younger rebels in the east, who make up a large portion of that group, toward anyone who held a major position in Gaddafi's government who has defected. And being the interior minister, that meant that he was in charge of cracking heads and maintaining security. So he was particularly mistrusted by many of them. But beyond that, there are the tribal tensions that have arisen because of his tribe reacting to the assassination, which caused the head of the Transitional National Council in the East to dismiss his entire council, knowing he had a crisis on his hands. But a number of members of that council were former Gaddafi officials of some weight, and so actually dismissal of the council will certainly please a lot of the younger clientele in the East.
Well, what about the role of Islamists? What happened there? I mean, that was the one of the reports.
That still remains opaque, honestly, the extent to which Islamists are embedded significantly in the Eastern opposition. They certainly made up the bulk of the more hardened fighters during the 1990s who took on Gaddafi in the East. But we do see a lot of secular elements in that mix as well, and so I don't think they're in a dominant position. In the West, in Libya, where we've seen actually far more success, you know, on the part of the rebels, particularly recently with the breakthrough from the mountains all the way to Zawiya on the coast, which rebelled earlier and then was put down very bloodily, and is now partially liberated again, severing Gaddafi partially from the Tunisian border, which is major. In that area where gains have been made, the rebels do not seem to be mainly Islamist at all. That's the more cosmopolitan part of the country. They're either tribal from the mountains and Berbers from the south, or they're coastal, coming from coastal cities, which are more secular than the East ever was.
Well, I understand that the Berbers are actually pretty formidable fighters, and I think they're, I guess it's the CIA that's in there arming them, but the arms, I think, are coming from Qatar, aren't they?
Yes, but that mainly is going to the Eastern opposition. The Qataris don't have much of a connection to the rebels in the West. In fact, the rebels in the West are even bringing in arms from African states like Chad and Niger that they are bringing in by caravan and by vehicle from areas that they've carved out as corridors to them in the south. But the rebels in the West have put up a formidable defense and offense. And in Misrata, beleaguered Misrata, that withheld one assault after another from Gaddafi, did something very interesting this week. The rebels there received reinforcements from the east, a very large number of reinforcements, and they sent them back, saying they were of substandard quality and they didn't want to fight. Which makes us wonder about this difference between the West and the East, and to the extent that the rebels in the West keep making stunning gains and stunning stands against Gaddafi, which is not mirrored in the East, where things have just remained stalled. One wonders when Gaddafi's overthrown. I think he will be. It could take a lot of time, but I think he will be. What's going to be the lineup internally, not only in terms of Islamists, but regional? I can just see if Gaddafi falls because of major gains being made by Western rebels, the Western rebels saying, wait a minute, to the Transitional National Council in the East that they have not yet recognized, by the way. We did the lion's share of the fighting here and right close to where his center of gravity was, and so we're the ones in charge here, not you. So we could see regional problems.
Again, I'm speaking with Wayne White, who's previously served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. So what explains the difference then between the effective rebels, militarily effective rebels on the West and the lackluster majority on the East?
It's very mysterious, and it's something that I've been focusing on myself, trying to scratch my head and figure out what is going on. Now, that said, there are traditional differences between Tripolitania, you know, named after Tripoli, which is the western portion of Libya, and then Cyrenaica, ancient Cyrenaica, which is the eastern part of Libya that, you know, was colonized by the Greeks and the Phoenicians long ago. And so we know there are cultural differences between East and West, which is why the unrest in the 90s was confined to the East. And the East is a bit more religious than the West and less cosmopolitan. But as far as fighting quality, it's inexplicable. Here we have the Eastern rebels fighting now weeks to just gain some neighborhoods and chunks of the oil port of Brega that's been fought over repeatedly. And meanwhile, in the West, isolated with far less in the way of weaponry, far less in the way of regular resupply without a port like Benghazi to bring weapons in, they are outmatching the performance of the rebels in the East dramatically, just dramatically. The breakthrough to the coast that occurred just yesterday was a stunning coup de main on the part of the Western rebels.
So Wayne White, again, former State Department intelligence analyst on Libya, the Hamis, the one of Gaddafi's sons, who apparently headed up the most effective military unit he has, supposedly was killed by NATO, and NATO just continues to bomb Libya and presumably did they bomb a caravan that was taking arms to the rebels? What was that about? You mentioned that arms coming up from the south.
Right, the rebels fighting in the mountains in the south and in the west maintain that that's exactly what happened, that thinking it was embargoed weapons destined for the regime and well aware of Gaddafi's connections to African governments, apparently bombed a camel caravan bringing in weapons for the rebels. I take that at face value. It probably did. Because there is very poor coordination between NATO and the rebels in the West. In the East, it's far better. In the West, it's very spotty, particularly the ones that are inland, as opposed to the ones holding the big port of Misrata, which is getting regular supplies, and Médecins Sans Frontières and other people are going in and out of it all the time.
So what's happening, though? Obviously, there was, for the longest time, there have been words of caution coming from a number of quarters about who exactly is NATO supporting, who are these people, what do they stand for, and what kind of a government will replace Gaddafi. And there's also been concerns about turning over the vast amounts of the money that's frozen. Gaddafi, obviously, the entire treasury of Libya was his own private piggy bank for him and his billionaire brat sons, who believe it or not, a lot of so-called revolutionaries still think that the guy is somehow kind of revolutionary hero instead of a murderous kleptocrat. But at any rate, the long and the short of it is that it seems that there's some anxiety about turning this money over, and not a lot of it has been turned over. And it sounds like there's good reason to be cautious about who it is we're supporting. You're suggesting that it could end up, after Gaddafi goes, that there could be a clash between the East and the West.
Yes, and that could really pose difficulties for powers that have recognized the Eastern Transitional National Council, because they may be confronted. I mean, we're really thinking ahead here. Gaddafi's fall hasn't even occurred, and some people don't even think that'll happen. But anyway, yes. There are reasons to be concerned about that, and two that jump right out at me are, one, who are they? In other words, you don't want to turn over a large amount of money to people with an Islamist, anti-West, anti-American agenda, if that is what turns out to be in the East in particular. But second, there is the problem of corruption. Gaddafi, in his kleptocracy, made corruption absolutely rife in the country. If anybody who worked for Gaddafi was almost by definition corrupt, and his officials are in the council in the East and are flecked here and there within it, and of course the tendency trickles down to everyone else in the country. And so there's one reason to keep that money tightly in hand and let it out only as needed, is to prevent it from just being siphoned away into all sorts of pockets. That's a serious problem with the money, in addition to who are we giving it to, and let's therefore give it slowly.
So you mentioned that a lot of people think, Wayne White, that Gaddafi's by no means finished. It does seem inevitable, doesn't it, that he will go? I mean, it's pretty amazing that he's hung on this long. What is the glue? I mean, it's the same question that one has to ask about the Assad regime in Syria, where clearly I don't think the U.S. and Israel and other countries are that anxious to see them go. I think there's a vast amount of hypocrisy going on there, which you're welcome to comment on. But just touching on Libya, what's your explanation of why this has taken so long to oust him? Because clearly he's an appalling leader who's looted the country and created this cult of personality that is just, disgusting.
One of them is inertia, and that is simply people reluctant to change in the capital. People are just nervous about any sort of major change that might upset their own personal rice bowls. And rice bowls leads me to the next one. A lot of the merchants in Tripoli, a lot of major traders in Tripoli and others are part of that kleptocracy, and so are asking themselves, well, where will we be if he goes? And therefore uncertain and unwilling to break with the current regime. And more than that, and we've got to look to Iraq for a lesson in this respect, and that is they look upon the rebels as this amorphous mass of scraggly, undisciplined forces, particularly in the West, where they've had to really scrape together a military force, and wonder what happens when they break into the capital. Is Tripoli going to be Baghdad 2003? Looting, theft, et cetera. You can just imagine the sort of the ruling classes and the established middle classes of Tripoli, despite a hatred on the part of the more westernized and thinking members of that class, of Gaddafi, what they think their capital could look like after a month with the rebels in charge.
So it's a kind of inertia. Wayne, are you describing a kind of Mad Max situation?
Exactly. They are terrified that their capital is going to be looted and there'll be no governance. And so that's a big hesitation, particularly when they look and see a situation in which, for example, the formidable rebels who are now making breakthroughs all over in the West, stunning this week, are not accepting the authority of the Transitional National Council. But are still a very, very unorganized group, seemingly. But more and more, we might see cracks because the inevitable weakening of the regime is happening. The Khamis Brigade, the 32nd Brigade, was weak to start with. Mm-hmm. This is not the 4th Armored Division in Syria. This is not the Syrian Republican Guard. It was the best part of the Libyan army, but still substandard. And it's been worn out, attrited away through combat, and that's why you're seeing these rebel breakthroughs, because the Khamis Brigade that was stopping them, 3 or 4 months ago, isn't there anymore in the same number of strength with the same number of vehicles. It's really been worn down. And so we're seeing Gaddafi unable to do much more than flail around and try to, smack away threats even near his own capital.
So, Wayne White, I mentioned the connections or similarities with the Assad regime hanging on against a popular uprising in Syria, and the Syrian regime have resorted now to using their warships against their own people, shelling the port of Laqatiya. So it's pretty disgusting. But do you share my skepticism about whether or not the United States and Israel and other powers, European powers, really want this regime to go?
I do. I think they're very close to a tipping point now, as more and more pressure even comes from the region, like from Turkey. to get rid of him, because of the nature of the brutality and the fact that refugees are beginning to flow. But there's nervousness at the same time about what is going to replace him, because the last time there was a major challenge to this regime between 1978 and 1982, and it was bloody, and I covered it. It was 90% Muslim Brotherhood. And so people are naturally terrified of having the Muslim Brotherhood take over, which would be considerably more anti-American, anti-Israeli, anti-West than the current regime.
Yeah, but this current regime is supported by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, who sent in their besieged militias and the IRGC people. They've apparently sent in their sophisticated anti-internet equipment that they use to shut down the Green Revolution and social networking. They have given the Assads $6 billion to keep them afloat. I thought we didn't like the Revolutionary Guard Corps regime in Tehran, and I don't understand how much are they any worse than the Muslim Brotherhood would be, or
well,
better?
It's very ironic because even Iran is deeply worried about the fall of the Assad in that respect, because a radical Sunni Arab movement in Syria would potentially be hostile to the Shia regime in Iran and take a different posture toward it than the current Assad regime.
And right, that's why Maliki has joined in supporting the in Iraq. He's joined in supporting the Assad killers.
Undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. And so this is another little complicator. Now, it is quite possible that a pragmatic Islamic regime in Damascus could make an alliance of convenience, with the Iranians, because it would be so desperately in need of funds and whatnot, and put aside that kind of hatred, and that might work too. But the Iranians undoubtedly have a real case of nerves over this beyond the obvious. But we are very nervous, too, and the Israelis, about what might replace Assad. One, an Islamist regime, or two, because it looks like the Islamists are much weaker now in Syria. Two, chaos, just a long period of instability in Syria, much like we saw before the Assads took over and strong-armed all that instability into the ground. Before that, Syria was called the coup of the month club country, and that instability itself would make it more difficult to manage, the truce along the Golan Heights and what we have in the way of any kind of peace in southern Lebanon.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Wayne White. We travel far and wide, but I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Iran and Iraq. He's a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups, and as a senior regional analyst. He also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back joined by Gloria Steinem.
Count on me to stay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gloria Steinem, who is the founder of Ms. Magazine and the co-founder of the Women's Media Center and an active member of Equality Now. She is the subject of a new HBO documentary that airs Monday, Gloria in Her Own Words. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gloria Steinem.
Thank you so much.
And in your own words, Gloria, this is not your movie. In other words, somebody else made this movie about you.
Yes, it was scary. I mean, but these are excellent documentary makers whose work I knew. Sheila Nevins at Home Box Office is the queen of documentaries. You know, I think she has won many more Academy Awards than anyone else in the world. So I was honored to be asked, and I thought, okay, I'll just jump off the cliff. So I just answered questions as honestly as I could, and sort of tried to look at each tree and let them figure out what the forest looked like.
And there is no narrator, is there?
No, no. It actually, the earlier and first one was done about Senator Ted Kennedy, called In His Own Words. Hmm. And it is an interesting format. I had seen it like that. It does give you a much better sense of knowing someone.
So a lot of the reviewers have said that this film is valuable in as much as a new generation of young women in this country don't appreciate the struggle that you and others went through and began. And is feminism taken for granted amongst the young?
Well, I hope so. No, I mean, the point is not people to make, not to make young women or young men grateful. Gratitude never radicalized anybody. We need to know our history, because otherwise we tend to be told that we were given these things. You know, that's what came down to me. Women were given the vote. That was the whole sentence in my textbook. So it's terribly important to know how change happened in the past so we can continue to make it. But I did not walk around saying thank you for the vote. I got mad because of what was happening to me, and I think that's what happens to young women too, and it's why there are actually, you know, many, many, many more feminists now than there were in the past. If you look at the public opinion polls, these issues are majority concerns when they weren't even named before.
So let me ask you, though, about the current political climate, at least as it appears. We had recently a economic hostage crisis in London, in Washington, D.C., entirely manufactured by the right wing of the Republican Party, who appear to have captured the Republican Party and, more importantly, captured the national policy. Forcing the president to essentially sign off on a really lousy deal that is going to hurt the economy and hurt the Democrats' chances of being reelected. So I don't see an active left or even an active center in the country. So what explains the ascendance of the right in this country? And after all, Michelle Bachmann just won in Minnesota. And, you know, I suppose the good news there is that she's made Sarah Palin irrelevant, right?
Well, you know, there's a big difference between what is going on in public opinion polls and what is going on in political life in Washington. Most people think taxes should be increased for those that can pay. You know, most people actually want more government services, not fewer government services. So what we're seeing in Washington is the capture of one of the two big political parties, the Republican Party, by what is actually at the peak a third of the country, and it's usually much less. Many of them used to be Democrats, like the Jesse Helmses of the world, and fled the Democratic Party in the South when it became too racially integrated for them, and gradually over time took over the structure of the Republican Party. And I agree with you that this is incredibly dangerous, because if people look at the media, they think issues are 50-50 when they're really 70-30. And if you're fed up with the Democrats, which we often are, there's no place to go except this extremist-controlled party. So it's incredibly dangerous, but it does not mean there's not a very active, caring majority in this country.
Well, 82% of the American people felt that the deal that we just were talking about, the debt ceiling deal, was a lousy deal, and that they think jobs should be a priority and not cutting the deficits. So
yeah, so I think it's terribly important not to blame people for what isn't their fault. It only makes us feel more disempowered. But to say what we can do about it. I mean, I devoutly hope that real Republicans of the Rockefeller and other, I mean, it's especially true for women Republicans, you know, because the Republican Party used to be much more in favor of female equality, the Equal Rights Amendment, and so on, than the Democratic Party was. Now they've been deserted by their party, but we have to take back the Republican Party so that it's centrist again and a real alternative.
But I was curious, though, about the disconnect between the people and the government, and I'm wondering if that is to do with the capture of our politics by money, where money is more powerful than votes and people. And it seems to me that in many ways we should be having a national debate upon the very nature of our democracy, whether or not we've become a plutocracy.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, and I know I was looking at the figures at the beginning of the women's movement. I think the average CEO made 70 times the average employee, and now it's 1,000 times. I mean, you know, we are more divided into rich and poor than any other modern democracy in the world, and this is a huge shame and an enormous danger. But it does not relieve us of responsibility, because the one place in the world where a pauper and a millionaire are equal, where, you know, the least powerful person is in the voting booth. And to the extent that this all could have been avoided by 10% more voters, we have to take responsibility and organize better next time.
Again, I'm speaking with Gloria Steinem, who is the subject of the new HBO documentary that airs Monday, Gloria, in her own words. And in terms of the growing disparity in wealth in the country, let's talk about the employment disparity, particularly with women, in terms of equal pay. Where does that stand? Because So, as you know, my daughter's in medical school, and there are more women in her class than men, and I believe that's the case in a lot of law schools around the country. So there's a mixed message here.
Well, actually, there are about half of undergraduates now who are female, but women go to get a BA in order to get out of the pink-collar ghetto and into the white-collar ghetto. But it's still, I mean, actually, if they entered a male working class, blue collar, unionized occupation, say if they became an electrician or a plumber, they would make more money than they would with a BA. So there's still a big gender divide, and it's part of the reason that, depends on the part of the country you're in, but the women earn something like 78 cents on the dollar that men earn. But I think you see it especially painfully. I'm glad you talked about college, because one of the great shames of this country is that we don't have free public education, as is mostly the case in Europe. So kids are graduating from college with more collective debt than the entire credit card debt of this nation. Now, that's bad for everybody, women and men, but it's especially bad for women, because a woman with a BA degree over her lifetime will earn $2 million less than a man with a BA degree. So it's much harder for her. It's hard enough for a guy. It shouldn't be true for anybody, but it's even harder for women to pay back their college debt.
Well, that phenomenon, though, I think has a lot to do with the Republican efforts at privatization, where the government, big government, is the enemy. But what they've in fact done is they've created a kind of racket, where what it's really going on is the transfer of public money into private hands, and that the taxpayer is getting hosed. for-profit education in this country takes up $40 billion of taxpayers' money. A lot of these schools are absolute scams. They give these kids worthless education, worthless diplomas, and pile them with debt, because essentially what they do is they take government money that they get for next to nothing and charge that money back to these kids with incredible interest rates that indenture them for life. And of course, they have no employment opportunities because their education was totally fictional.
No, you're absolutely right. Actually, I was sitting next to, I spent a lot of time on planes, you know, so I have lots of plane conversations. And I was sitting next to a very right-wing guy who was quite honest. And he said, you know, what we want to do is to create a cheap labor supply here because we don't want to have to rely on foreigners.
They're doing a hell of a job.
You're right.
But no, you have to add to that that they're also dumbing the population down.
That summed it up.
Yeah.
And of course, especially under Bush, but also altogether, we've been selling off the government one function at a time. The idea that for-profit corporations can run prisons, for instance, that Wackenhut or somebody can run, you know, is ridiculous and cruel. And it's why some of the Abu Ghraib guards, remember Abu Ghraib from Iraq, came from Texas, because Bush was a pioneer in selling off prisons and making them profit centers, which meant they got less and less good guards and less good services and were more and more likely to release people even more motivated to break the law.
Just in the last few minutes, I'd like to turn to work that you do, Gloria Steinem, that people aren't aware of, and that is in terms of environmental protection and also the protection of endangered human species like the Kalahari Bushmen. But in specifically, you mentioned George W. Bush. Of course, the current South Korean president is often referred to as Korea's George W. Bush, or he's otherwise known as Mr. Bulldozer, since he comes out of the construction business. And there is an island that you visited and written about south of South Korea. That's a World Heritage Site that's about to be turned into a missile base aimed at China, not North Korea, and the people there are fighting back heroically.
Yes, the great heroes of this battle are the people of Jeju Island, which is at the southern tip of South Korea, who, especially in the area of the naval base where the fishing village, the government had tried to impose it on two other villages who said no, and finally they just imposed it on one no matter what. And those people have been living along the shoreline in tents for 4 years in order to safeguard the land and the soft coral reef and all of the great environmental and cultural advantages that belong to all of us on this earth. And because they have been living there and they have become this magnetic place, I was there 11 years ago before, 9 years ago before this started, so I had some familiarity with the island. When I went back in May, I went to see these demonstrators, and I discovered there was a young couple of documentarians there who had come just to visit and had been staying for 6 weeks with only the clothes on their back. There was a young Frenchman with us who stayed and is still there. I mean, you know, this is an incredibly important magnetic issue that is the kind of thing we'll be judged on in centuries to come. The South Korean government says, I don't know whether it believes or not, but says that this is for the protection of South Korea from North Korea, which isn't true at all. There is no protection because the missiles would be too low and too difficult to stop. It really is part of our Aegis, AEGIS missile system that is designed to surround China, and China has very much objected to, naturally. So it's both... a dangerous provocation in the arms race, a destruction of the environment, and a destruction of this island, which, like all very, very old cultures, was egalitarian, was matrilineal, was, you know, st- still has some of that tradition. So all the movements have that I know of have coincided in trying to fight this missile base, and yet it's really not in the news. I wrote an New York Times op-ed page piece about it. You can go online and just type in Save Jeju Island, and you'll find a petition to object to it.
And Jeju is J-E-J-U.
J-E-J-U,
Jeju Island, right. Well, the way you describe the place is just magical, you know, in your op-ed. Green hills covered with wildflowers, mandarin orange groves, nutmeg forests, tea plantations, and rare orchids growing wild. I'm afraid we've run out of time. Here I am going on. Thank you so much for joining us, Gloria.
Thank you so much, Ian, and thank you for what you do. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Gloria Steinem, who is the founder of Ms. Magazine and the co-founder of the Women's Media Center and an active member of Equality Now. She is the subject of a new HBO documentary that airs Monday, Gloria in Her Own Words. So what did we learn on today's background briefing? Well, we began talking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the director at the Center for Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota, and of course the Minnesota twins, Michelle Bachmann and Governor Pawlenty, were pretty much the focus of attention in the Iowa straw poll and the Republican candidate debate that preceded it. And of course Michelle Bachmann was the winner, and Pawlenty just pulled out of the race, and we were looking into whether or not Bachmann was a viable national candidate, and at the very least, the default position would be perhaps that she could end up as vice president. If, for example, a Romney won and needed to balance the ticket with somebody that would please the base. Now, those calculations may be kind of out the window because of the possibility of the governor of Texas, Perry, essentially making Bachmann irrelevant. But Jacobs didn't think so. He thought she was a serious and formidable candidate. He certainly wouldn't write her off. Then we talked about who are the opposition in Libya. A lot of people have been concerned about them from day one, whether it's a good idea to give arms and money to these people. We don't know who they are. I talked to State Department Specialist Intelligence Bureau guy from the INR, Wayne White, who essentially made it even more pessimistic, I think, that not only do we quite know who they are, whether the Islamists killed the general in their ranks recently. But the long and short of it is, he said that the rebels in the West are really being effective and getting no support. The rebels in the East are totally useless. And he thinks that the rebels in the West, Berbers in particular, will eventually take Tripoli, and then they'll do all the fighting. And then the guys in the East that we've been supporting and that NATO's been supporting will then try to come into town. And the Western guys will say, no, we won the war. And thus you will have the contours of a civil war. And then finally, Gloria Steinem joined us. Just a total pleasure to speak with her. HBO has a new documentary coming out on Monday called Gloria in Her Own Words. And we spoke about that documentary, which she had nothing to do with, but content of the documentary. But then we talked a lot about stuff that she does that people don't know about, which is her works on the environment, trying to save an island off the coast of Korea and the Kalahari Bushmen. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.